dwelling in the darkest depths of the mind. It's time for Mark D. Valenti and Brain Burrow.
Hello, everyone. This is Mark D. Valenti for Brain Burrow. This is one of our Digging Deep sessions where we have an opportunity to talk with our guest to really get their perspective, thoughts, feelings, motivations, goals, values, struggles, and strengths, and then let you, the viewer and listener, decide, oh, how does this relate to my life? So I'm very pleased to have on the show today Mr. Tony Martin, and I'm going to hand it over to Tony with a big open-ended question. Who exactly is Tony Martin?
Hi, thank you so much for having me on. It's absolutely fantastic. Thank you so much, Mark. Who is Tony Martin? All right, that is a bit of an open-ended question. That is massive. So Tony Martin is directing a film. He's a lifelong... I'm going to stop talking in third person now. I can't do that. I am a lifelong horror film fan. I was a teacher, school teacher for many, many years. And I kind of had enough of that. It wasn't as fulfilling me anymore. And I was teaching kids and young people who were disadvantaged and weren't coping with mainstream education, and it was fantastic. And I was doing some good, but it was it's got a shelf life. You know, mentally and physically, that was exhausting. So I quit teaching and I started doing a bit of extras work. Then from that, I did some acting work. And then a little 15-minute short film I was going to make for somebody else has turned into this big production, which we can talk about later. You know, as I'm a massive horror film fan, always have been from my earliest memories watching films I'd recorded with my mum on a Saturday night. We'd come down together on a Sunday morning. And watch them, you know, really early before my dad got up. So it'd be like Hammer and Amicus, stuff like Universal Monsters. So I've got really fond memories of doing that. That's if we set the video right, you know, and the timer, because often, you know, they were quite complicated back in the day. And we hadn't rewound the cassette properly. So you've got like half the film. But it was that's who I am, really. I my degree's in art. I'm an artist as well. I enjoy writing. I do a bit of poetry, illustration. My love is horror films, really. And that's kind of why we're here today, I suppose, to talk about The Witches of the Sands and everything. I live in Whitstable. I live just up the road from Peter Cushing's old house, which is pretty cool.
Really cool.
Yeah, and that was a bizarre sort of coincidence, but it happened when I met my now wife. She happened to live in Whitstable. I wasn't living too far away in Canterbury, I ended up living in Whitstable, you know, which was great, you know, which is it's kind of fate, maybe, I don't know. I met Peter Cushing once before I lived here when I was 14. And that was a weird story as well, actually. I'm rambling on about it if you want. I was 14, and we'd we lived in a place called Gillingham, which is about 40-45 minutes from Whitstable. And we come out, Whitstable's a lovely little seaside town, so it's a little harbour and it's famous for its oysters and Peter Cushing. And so we came with my family and we saw a poster advertising an evening with Peter Cushing. You know, so this would have been 1986. So I was 14. I was a massive, as I say, massive horror film fan at the time. And so my dad got us a ticket. And what I didn't know is he'd rung them up, the organisers, beforehand and said, is there any chance that my son, who's a massive fan, could meet him before the interview, you know, before he goes on stage?
Wow.
So I did. So I met him, you know, and had a chat with him. And, it's one of my best memories, you know, absolutely mad. And I've got a beautiful photo of us together. I mean, I look like a total geek, but I was like, you know. He's got his beautiful suit on, you know, Dynasty. Yeah, of course, exactly. But that was that memory. I mean, I can talk about that all day, you know. And the funny thing is, as well, another weird coincidence is that I found the ticket not long ago, and the interview was held at St. Edmund's School Hall, which is the school my son goes to, or has just literally just left. But I didn't realise that until I found this ticket, and I thought, well, that's another weird kind of coincidence, you know. So. But yeah, so that's kind of who I am. I mean, you can see I'm pretty enthusiastic about horror and stuff like that.
I would say that's an understatement, but yes, you're definitely enthusiastic.
I can't help it. You know, it's like, I just get so much joy out of it, you know, especially talking about that story. I've got very fond memories coming down watching these films with my mum. I remember one time, I must have been, I can't remember, you know, 10, maybe 11. I remember the Hammer logo came up and my mum saying something like, oh, it's a Hammer film, so it's bound to be good, or something along those lines. You know, it gives it a certain gravitas, you know, this film, because it was a Hammer film, you know, you kind of knew what you were getting yourself into. And that always stuck with me, you know, my mum saying that. And that kind of went on from there, really. So,
I mean, thank you for sharing that story. It's clear that it does have an emotional impact on you. And it's actually a pretty cool freaking story, too, I think. So that was actually really interesting. Actually, there's so many things, you know, I want to ask you now, because, you know, you shared an awful lot in the last few minutes of very important information. But let's do the obvious thread here. So you're obviously a Hammer fan, because you've just said that, and obviously met Peter Cushing. How has that experience and your enjoyment of those films influenced your filmmaking and, you know, what you're doing with Witches and all of that?
So we have a scene, the Witches of the Sands, I'm describing it now as if Monty Python made horror. That's kind of where we are
with it. Oh, that's so cool.
It kind of encapsulates everything, because it's quite, it's got two narratives kind of running through it, but then it's got all these little sort of sections and non sequitur sort of scenes and some animation, and there's some quite funny bits and over the top gory bits. And it's just very kind of off the wall. And it just kind of reminds me now of a Monty Python film. So there's lots of little bits and pieces, lots of homages to films and subgenres that I like. So when I asked Deborah Lamb, my mutual friend Deborah, to be in it, and she said yes, it was amazing. And then she's like saying, so actually what I'm doing in a couple of weeks is flying to Philadelphia to meet up with my friend Mark Bonacore, who's a director. And he's got some, you know, knights, armor, costumes, you know, we can get a team together. What do you want us to do? So I'm like, well, can we do this? And they just went off and filmed it, you know. And I kind of said, I want it to be like a gothic Hammer opening, you know. So like Deb was like walking through the woods, you know, very, very Hammer-like period costumes. And then she's not one of the goodies. She's actually the baddie and the knights. Then we have these knights kind of surrounding her, and then the story unfolds from there. So there's a huge influence, and that opens the whole film as well, which is going to kind of surprise people, because then we obviously go to present day, but then we go back and forth to lots of different time periods. So in terms of how it's influenced me, hugely in that one scene, you know, in particular, because I just love, I love the visuals of the Hammer films, you know, when the bright red blood splats across the tree, you know, and so we've got some of that in, and we threw it around a bit, and I think I did that in Captain Kronos, something very similar kind of feel to it, and then we flip it and it turns out that she's the nasty one, the baddie that the knights have tracked down, and one of the knights plays is one of my ancestors, the character I play. So it's a huge influence. There you go, I'll shut up, that's it, done.
No, you don't. there's no time limit. It's whatever you want to talk about.
That's it. I mean, how I grew up with Hammer films. You know, I've been really lucky. I met Peter Cushing. I met Christopher Lee a few times. Ingrid Pitt, awesome. Michael Ripper. Carolyn Monroe. You know, a lot of the Pauline Pierre, of course, who's in Witches, who was in The Satanic Rites of Dracula, and. You know, all these things, and especially visually, play a huge part in that in the film, and especially saying that scene, yeah, definitely.
Yeah, I mean, again, I think your passion for this is definitely oozing. It's really cool to see, and it's exciting. And I actually was not expecting to talk about Hammer Films today. That's exciting too.
My passion is I'm really my passion. So it's kind of stepped over my filmmaking ability. what I'm really fortunate enough to have is a lot of amazing friends and talented filmmaker friends who have all helping just because they believe in the project, which is fantastic, you know. And we all help each other out. I've done some acting in some of their films, or I help out where I can. You know, I've just done, you know, I'm quite good, you know, art-wise. So I've just done some sort of special effects stuff for some other guys that you were editing, and they're doing their film. We're all helping each other. But the amount of love this film has got has humbled me. Because it's a lot of time these people are putting in. There's one of the, I don't know if you've seen the still, but there's these, we've got some strange flying sandwich demons. It's the best way I can describe them. That. And one of them, one of my characters sort of, we see this sort of sandwich fly into the fridge, and my character sort of looks again, opens the fridge, and we have it flying out. And do you know the film Deadly Spawn?
Yeah, yes.
So we wanted these teeth to look very deadly, sort of like rows and rows and rows of teeth, you know, like that. So this sandwich, I mentioned that because the guy who did all the this is all digital. This is like the most of it's all practical effects, but this is all digital. And Matt Westrup, who did that for me, is so unfortunate because he lives literally 10 meters from my house. So it was like, wow. so every five minutes, I'm like, Matt, I got an idea. So, you know, poor bloke, he couldn't get away from me. You know, Matt, have you done those sandwiches yet? You know, but he's great. And he animated some of the gorillas on their first tour. He's done some, you know, games and films and stuff.
Wow.
So he's directed and stuff. And he's just finished directing a video for a group called Band Called Hybrid, who are very cool. You know, so he's just one example of all these professional filmmakers and who have come on board. You know, my editors, Alex and Mike, they're directors and editors in their own right. Their first film, I Scream on the Beach, has been brilliantly at the festivals. They're doing a second one, Mosaic, at the moment, which I'm also in. And then we've got we've just got everyone, like Danny Thompson is quite well known screen queen in the UK. She's in it. It's just everyone's chipping in. And obviously, then the bigger it's got, the more the people happier people are to be involved, which is great for me, you know. So as I say, my passion is there, but
that's right.
But without these people around me, it would just be passion, you know. It started off as a 15-minute film, a 15-minute short.
Yeah.
Sam Mason Bell asked me to kind of do, to get involved in, because he was putting together an anthology of four or five short films, ghost hunting, found footage over 3 days. So I was doing that. And then this kind of got bigger and bigger. And then Sam's film then fell through because it didn't have enough people to make the other segments. So then that kind of gave me the leeway to expand mine. But without like Sam and all these other people, it would be a very different entity.
Yeah, I think that's pretty amazing, right? Because it keeps spreading out, right? Even because of Deborah's involvement, and then she mentioned to me, and that's just a small part of it, let alone all the people that are working on it. I mean, it's just, it actually represents how well the indie horror community always comes together to support each
Absolutely.
Other.
Absolutely.
So I think
Absolutely.
That's...
It's great.
Yeah, so I think... the question I have for you then, kind of going back to your perspective and the way you navigate situations, how does it feel accepting all this help?
Oh, like I said, I mean, I'm very humbled mm-hmm. By it. I literally could not do it without the help. Now, I've just had my fundraiser, and I've hit my target. When that's really going to help, which means we can make it, you know, a bit bigger and better and stronger. But I'm happy to accept. I'm happy to accept help. I'm not proud. I said to everyone, you know, this. I said this is the only film I'm ever going to make. As a producer, directing I love and writing I love. But producing and not having a budget is a killer, because I want to pay people for their time, and everything they're doing, you know, which is the right thing to do. I'm very lucky that they're doing it free. But yeah, I mean, I've got no choice but to accept the help either, you know, otherwise it wouldn't happen. So, yeah, bring it on. Bring it on. That's not to say I haven't been able to pay a few people. You know, a few of the bigger names in it.
Sure.
I went with the agent. But a lot of people haven't taken any money, which has been fantastic. So, yeah.
No, I think that, and you brought up a point there. You said you don't have a choice but accept the help. But I believe that we always have choices. And you did have a choice to accept that. So I think, you know, as I mentioned earlier when I introduced the section, the segment here, is that people are watching these and saying, oh, what can I learn from it? And I think there's a powerful lesson that you're teaching here is about accepting help, because a lot of people struggle with accepting help. It's either pride or feel like they're maybe not worthy enough to accept help. So I'm wondering if you, Tony, could give any advice to anybody out there who's maybe struggling with accepting help, whether it's financial or support or whatever.
Well, sorry, are we okay there?
Yeah, it's okay. For some reason that's okay. We're good now.
From my perspective, I know my limitations. I've got these ideas, and I know how to express them, and I know how to direct other people to produce them, but I haven't got the technical ability for the sound, for the camera work, for the editing. And so there's no point me struggling and producing something that somebody else could do better. So I take on board the idea of pride and not wanting help, but you what's the word I'm looking for? You're cutting off your nose to spite your face. You're not going to get anywhere in life if you don't accept help. When people are happy to offer it. I don't know. I mean, I think I'm happy to accept help. I'm happy to give help where I can. It's strange, I suppose. Why wouldn't I accept help? You know, I mean, a lot of these things are happening in the film that have happened. I would not have a clue. All I've done is write it, talk to people, pointed my finger around, shout action or, you know, cameras rolling, whatever I've been shouting, and then other people but that's their job. That's what a film crew is. That's what teamwork is. That's because each person has their specific roles, but also people have their strengths, and everyone has their strengths and everyone has their weaknesses. To not accept help, I think is, yeah, I don't know, big-headed. I don't know. That's probably not the right word. I don't know. I don't understand personally why you wouldn't.
Sure.
If that makes sense. Yes, we've all got strengths. We've all got weaknesses. And other people are going to bounce through things better than you sometimes. And if you're not going to accept that help, then, like I say, you're going to make something inferior.
Yeah.
Because other people can do it better. So why struggle? You know.
No, I think that, and thank you for kind of going through that a bit, because it's an important lesson, though, because again, to your point, it may be difficult to understand why people don't accept help, you know, because you are willing to do it. And
I spent 19 years teaching as well, don't forget, mm-hmm. In a school. So when we talk about accepting help, and people also being afraid to ask for help, that's coming from a, you know, a different angle, because I'm thinking about school children maybe being embarrassed to ask for help in a public, you know, place like a classroom. But obviously, as a teacher, it was my job to help everyone, and that means catering to specific individual needs, and not everyone as one mass entity within the classroom. Which then means that you have to have some sort of personal connection, is not the right word, but you have to have an involvement with the people you're helping, to be able to help them to the best of your ability. I don't really know where I'm going with this. I'm kind of thinking out loud. But then you do get, of course, you do get some children and some young people who, for whatever reason, don't want to accept help, and not just young people, but obviously adults as well. And that's probably something to do with wanting to save face, like in front of other people. Also, I think upbringing somehow. Maybe they were taught at home that you know that to be the man or the woman or whatever, and you know, you don't need help, you need to do it yourself. I don't know, but. There's nothing wrong with asking. There's nothing wrong with seeking assistance. That's what we do from when we're born, you know.
And you bring up another good point. And yeah, we can speculate all day long about why certain people do it or don't do it. But the important part of this, Tony, is that you do it. And I believe it comes from a sense of self-worth, you know, where you feel confident in yourself. As you pointed out, some people don't like to ask for help because they want to save face. And that means that they're very tied into people's opinion of them. But you seem to be, talking with you, somebody who's very centered, very intrinsically motivated. And I'm wondering, where, Tony, does your sense of self-worth come from? Because it seems to be very strong.
My sense of self-worth is precariously balanced at all times. You know, well, I don't really talk about too much, like mental health and things. And, so without going into too much detail, life can be a struggle, I think, for most people, for a lot of people. Self-worth is a really hard thing to grasp and talk about, because what I'm doing is making a film, and that's it. It's not going to change the world. You know, I'm not curing diseases. I'm not volunteering to help build schools in Africa. It's kind of relative, and I struggle with it. I don't have a huge amount of self-worth. I think I don't do brilliantly at a lot of things that I would like to be better at. Self-worth's hard, because making this film, I can hark back to people helping me again, which means more than they know, you know, because I'm touched that so many people have feel like they want to help me. So that's what gives me a feeling of self-worth. The fact that people are willing to, the thing is, people donate money, that's great. Mm-hmm. But when people donate their time and their friendship and their experience, when they've got other things going on as well. Well, that makes me feel quite special. And undeserved. It's, I don't deserve it necessarily. I don't know. I mean, that's a really tough subject for me. I struggle with most things. I struggle with kind of life and and feeling worthy, I suppose. I keep doing stuff like drawing, and you know, I managed to sell some artwork, or I've just written a book of poetry that I'm hoping to get published, and I'm making a film, and I've been a teacher, and I've helped the disadvantaged children and things, but all these things I do don't really, they're great things, and I don't do it for the money, don't get me wrong, but I'm kind of fed up of not having any money at the same time. I'm kind of I think the problem I've got is that I just wish I could be a person who was happy to leave school, go to college, get a job and stick with their job and be happy doing the same thing or progressing through their company or whatever it is, you know, and then having the weekend off and then starting all over again on Monday. But this is what I struggle with. And I find that very hard. I get terribly, I suppose, for want of a better word, bored easily. But it's quite selfish of me as well, because I have a family, you know, so... I've made it harder in some respects by pursuing some of these choices that I've made. So I do little bits of jobs for cash in hand or whatever, and I do a bit of supply teaching, which I think you would call substitute teacher. I don't know. Sometimes I wish I could just have found a career path at 18 and just stuck with it. It's you know, it's a bit like, I'm feeling a bit like Van Gogh, but with both my ears still, but only just because, it's a kind of struggle that is almost, it's unavoidable. You know, every time I get a job, I think, right, I'm going to stick at this job. So I keep trying not, to swear.
You can swear if you want, by the way.
Every time I get a fucking job and I try and fucking stick at it, I think, right, I'm going to do it. I'll go into work. I can guarantee in about 3 or 4 weeks, I'll have pissed someone off. Probably subconsciously, because deep down I don't want to be there. I'd rather be doing something else. It's this constant struggle. And I'm not when I liken myself to Van Gogh, and I'm not talking in terms of my ability in any way, because you know Van Gogh was absolutely a master. But I just see a bit of myself in this struggle to create and produce, and he was such a loner, you know, and I am quite a big loner, you know. I'm more than happy, I'm happiest like when I'm at home, if I can avoid going out, then I will. Oh god, I feel really depressed now. No, I don't know. Let's cheer this up. Sorry.
No, first of all, that's the whole purpose of these interviews, right? It's to really kind of dig a little bit deeper, which I appreciate you doing that. It's not easy to talk about vulnerabilities and feelings, and it's normal to have emotions about things like this.
It's like asking for help. I mean, we're all vulnerable. Some more so than others, or some, I suppose, who are happy to acknowledge and work with the fact they are.
That's right. And you're willing to talk through that. And I think that is what's inspiring to others to say, okay, Tony looks like he has everything together. He's very good about accepting help. But then after you start talking about it, you know, you struggle like everybody else. I think you said precariousness, well, precarious balance is what you said.
Precarious balance. Well, this is the thing. I mean, it's very easy these days to show a veneer and a personality. You know, you've got Facebook, Twitter. You know, I could come talk to you now and just be very superficial. It's very easy to do. You know, when you can type something on Facebook and put a smiley emoji, and everyone think everything's fine. You know, but it's not like that. You know, but we're very good at, you know, we and Instagram. You know, we can even what's the word? Filter our faces to look totally different, and which is, you know, a huge mask in itself. It's very easy to not address who we are and for other people to think that everything's okay. And then of course you get the people on Facebook who say everything's not okay. And then, like, oh my God, it's gone on again. but things like Facebook, you know, things like Facebook and social media is not really, the right place for things like that. I don't know. Sure. I don't know. I'm just thinking out loud now.
No, it's okay. It's totally okay. Well, and, you know, and even your comment about, okay, we want to, you know, cheer this up. And I know it's kind of humorous. And I think that's what we use humor a lot too, to sort of redirect, you know, and I think that's, but it's effective, right? Because it, you know, we have those feelings where we want to focus on positives, but I think you did a great job in this discussion of balancing both, Tony, and I really appreciate that. I think as we're running out of time, I want to just, and it doesn't mean we can't talk again, by the way.
Okay.
If you're interested, I think, yeah. So I think maybe to kind of put a different spin on this, and not saying we want to brush over quote unquote negative thoughts or depressing thoughts, but maybe focus on, again, that self-worth question, because it sounds like, Tony, it's that balance. Sometimes you feel maybe you don't have as much self-worth. Sometimes you feel like you do, as you said, when people help you. And as human beings, we're social animals. So getting that feedback and help from other people makes us feel good in a certain way. And that's okay. So could you talk and this is the last question for the discussion today. Could you talk about, when do you feel that self-worth? When does Tony Martin feel that self-worth?
I'm not sure if I can put myself in a position where I do feel a huge amount of self-worth. I mean, I'm very proud of our children. I have two stepdaughters and a son and three grandchildren. I suppose my feeling of self-worth comes from looking at the people they are, and the fact that I didn't screw up. I mean, of course, I have screwed up, but
we all have.
overall, I think everything's worked out pretty well with them. So, you know, and I can't take a huge amount of credit for my two stepdaughters. So they're my wife, their mum, and her ex. They're great parents, you know. So and we used to see him quite a bit, but I think obviously with COVID and stuff, we haven't so much lately. But we all get on and everything, which is nice. And but you know, that's their parents, and I'm there if needed, you know, as the step parent. But you know, when you see them having children and then going back to college to study, continue studying and things. That's where my self-worth comes from. In terms of things I do, very little. Again, it's kind of like back to that struggling artist thing. It's like, I struggle to like anything, much of what I do. And I question everything. To the point where I can love something. I think I've done something quite well. And then I'll go back to it like 10 minutes later or a day later, and I'll just want to throw it out or rewrite it or whatever it is I'm doing. I don't know. I don't know how to answer that question. I just don't know. I don't know because look, I wake up most days really excited to go and film Wizard of Sands. Really, really excited. Some days I wake up and wish I'd never started it. Some days I wake up and I'm petrified that it's not good. Some days I wake up and I know it's great. I wish I could just not do that. I wish everything was nice and clear. And I suppose that everyone, but it's quite draining mentally. It's draining. Sure. But again, when this is finished, when this is done, I think I'm going to love it. Would I get any feeling of self-worth out of it? No, probably not. I don't know. I could talk about this for hours, I think, and with you, because if you're only just kind of getting started on it, and you've actually made me, you're making me, I'm thinking, you know, it's tricky.
Well,
I thought you were going to ask me what my favorite horror film was. I thought we were going to be that deep.
No, it's more about a little bit further than that. And again, yeah, no, cool. it's your choice on how much you want to share, because it's really from within you. You know what I mean? So thank you for being willing to share. And like I said, you know, in some of these sessions that I've had with people, yeah, I can still, it's just your image. Okay. I see. Yeah. People decide to go a bit deeper, and I probably bring people back for second discussions if they want to, because there is so much more, right? This isn't, you know, what's your favorite horror film or what's your favorite actor or whatever. I mean, those are answer in a second, right? These are things we're really talking about digging deep. So I think I want to, you know, kind of maybe leave with a couple thoughts about what you just said, if that's okay. And then we'll end the show. Yeah. So Tony, I want to say you and your willingness to even share all of this, I think says a lot about your ability to connect with people and ability to be a little bit vulnerable. So I want to, you know, commend you on that. As far as self-worth, there's a, I've referenced this on the show a couple of times. I don't think on Deborah's. There's a book called Drive by Dan Pink. It's about what motivates us. And the highest level of motivation is intrinsic motivation. And one of the levels of intrinsic motivation is our ability to influence those around us. Extrinsic would be if you expected everybody to say, Tony, you're the greatest. Thank you. Like you're looking for that approval. And that's not what I hear from you. What I hear is your intrinsic motivation to make people around you better. And that's a sense of purpose. And I think that in of itself says a huge, powerful message about your self-worth, whether it's, you know, with your family or whether with the people in the community. So you just identified that just now about when you have that intrinsic motivation and self-worth. So again, phenomenal, because a lot of people don't get to that point. You also talk about wanting to get better. You're saying that things aren't perfect. Well, I mean, we can have a different discussion about perfection paralysis and maybe a different day. But as human beings, we live in an imperfect world, and we're imperfect all the time. For goodness sakes, I mean, I was, my coffee's cold right here because it's one thing that's messed up on one thing, right? But your drive to want to improve yourself is also intrinsic motivation. Now, the bigger questions that you may could reflect on this maybe for a different time is what would it take for Tony Martin to feel okay with something he's accomplished, even if it's not perfect, even if it's definitely not perfect, what would it take? So I think that's a self-reflective question. But yeah. So yeah. Tony, yeah, immediate thoughts to what I said, and then we'll end the show.
Let me just say this then. On a slightly more positive note, what's going to make me feel a sense of accomplishment is going to be finishing this film, because I have I've kind of stuck to my guns with it. And it's a strange film that's going to be a love or hate. I'm hoping it's going to be a lot of love for a lot of people. But I think, you know, if one person out of 100 takes something from it, then I'm happy with that. But like I said, I have no intention of doing this again. So this is my magnum opus. This is my dream, you know. So and I'm going to do it exactly how I want it. I had a contract come through from a well-known American cult film production company who were interested in the film, but they put quite a lot of stipulations in the contract, so I won't be signing that, because this is, you know, this is for me, really, and whoever else then is also in that same arena. There was something else that you touched upon that I was going to mention. It's gone. It's left my head. It's gone. Sorry.
It's okay.
That's where I am with that. It would be lovely to feel. I do, when I finish doing something, when I'm doing something, I do feel a sense of accomplishment. There's a feeling of accomplishment, but it's offset against other thoughts that I would have to think about further. I think I don't deserve. I almost feel like maybe I don't deserve to feel proud of something that I've achieved, or not. Maybe proud's a funny word. Proud's a strange term, I think, to be proud of something. You know, people say, "I'm proud to be English." Well, you were born in England. You're lucky. You could argue you're lucky to be English, mm-hmm. or you're lucky to be American, or you're lucky to be Indian, mm-hmm. whatever country you're born in. But sure. can you be proud to be English? I mean, I didn't do anything to be English, so can I be proud to be English? I don't even know where that's come from. It's popped into my head. I don't know why I said that.
It's
know.
Okay.
So proud's a funny word. I can't get to grips with the term pride, being proud of something. I find it awkward for whatever reason.
Yeah, I think that's also a great point, right? The language we use has different meanings to it as well. And to your point, you know, if you're lucky, quote unquote, enough to be put into, if you're lucky to be born with, let's say, superior athletic ability or intelligence or whatever, is that something you can really be, quote unquote, proud of versus studying for a test or accomplishing something which you did as a result of your drive or whatever? It's actually very interesting conversation in question. But I will say, unfortunately, we definitely are out of time. Again, doesn't mean we can't talk about this at some other point, even you know, on camera or not, of course. So, but I want to thank you, Tony, for really digging deep today. I know it wasn't always comfortable, but you pushed through it. So I want to thank you for being on the show today.
Well, thank you for asking questions that made me feel uncomfortable, I suppose. uncomfortable, but in a good way. I mean, it's nice. I'm happy to talk about my favorite horror films, don't get me wrong, but it's also nice to experience something like this as well. So I'm just off to my head in the sand for another 20 years and maybe just go to bed and think, because that's where I am now. I'm going to go and get that book Drive, maybe. I'm going to order that and see where we are with that.
Yeah, no, when you have conversations and really dig deep, it does drain you in some ways. So it's an opportunity to self-reflect. And I think that says a lot about your character, that you are going to self-reflect about things.
In what time? It must be about 3:00. So in 2 hours, you know, like I'm talking about jobs and money. And, you know, it's funny because I'm sort of directing this film with all these great people in it. In 2 hours' time, I am, for a bit of extra cash, going to be delivering Chinese takeaway for my Saturday night. So it's funny, you know, it's a funny world, but, you know, it's a bit of cash and I can put it in the drawer, you know. So, and I'd rather, and like I said, I'd rather be doing that than a full-time job. So,
yeah,
I don't know. It's funny. It's just popped into my head then, thinking about what I'm going to do next. I've had this sort of quite a deep conversation. And then in 2 hours' time, I'm literally going to be knocking on people's doors, handing them their Chinese takeaway and wondering if they're going to give me a £2 tip or not, you know. it just goes from one extreme to the other. And that's right.
That's draining.
That's what's draining sometimes, yeah. These extremes.
Yeah.
You know,
Well, it's an emotional roller coaster in a lot of ways, right? Sometimes you put your filters up and sometimes they're way down and going back and forth. So it makes sense. It's a good call out.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. So I want to thank, of course, the listeners and viewers out there. Thank you very much for tuning into Brain Burrow today. And on behalf of Tony Martin, this is Mark DiValenti. Have an amazing rest of your day.
You just dug deep with Mark D. Do you want more? Follow Mark on Instagram @ValentiHorror and subscribe to the Brain Burrow podcast.